Hey, y'all, before we get to the main interview, this is Brian. I just want to say real quick that Ledger Status Learn is live. You can go to ledgerstatus.com/learn. This is a cryptocurrency trading educational material and course that goes for 3 months. If you're ready to dig in and learn trading techniques, both from a fundamentals and technicals standpoint, learn risk management and so much other stuff, this is a community where we're going to be working together. I'll be feeding you content throughout that 3 months. We'll have live market analysis as part of what you get. Come join us. I think you'll like it. Go to ledgerstatus.com/learn. I'm really excited to have this live. And hurry up before the first class registration is over, because that's really, really soon. All right. Thanks. Bye. Hello and welcome to LedgerCast. My name is Brian Krogsgaard, and today I am talking to Peter McCormack. You may know him as What Bitcoin Did on Twitter and all the other places that he publishes. He has a podcast, but he's just done a lot of research on this ecosystem that I've enjoyed getting his take on. He doesn't claim to be a super expert. He does bring on some great guests who he tries to learn from. So this is a little bit of a cross-podcast pollination. I hope you enjoy it. I'd like to thank our sponsor for this episode, Delta. If you need to track your portfolio, which you do, if you're still invested in crypto, and I hope you are, then you need to be using Delta. It's the best way to do it. I manage 3 portfolios with Delta. Go to ledgerstatus.com/delta to learn more about it. They're always making great updates with this application, and I know that I can continuously monitor the performance of my portfolios and get great alerts on when Bitcoin or Ethereum or whatever else I'm trading is moving. Those are pretty nice and granular. Love the way they do that. Go to ledgerstatus.com/delta, and thanks so much to Delta for being a LedgerStatus partner. Now here's our show. Hello and welcome to LedgerCast. Today I have a fellow podcaster, but also someone with a very interesting journey of their own, both pre-crypto and in the crypto landscape. They've been making a name for themselves. I've got Peter McCormack, also known as What Bitcoin Did. Hey, Peter.
Hi, man. How are you?
I'm doing great. And it's a pleasure to have you on the show. I listen to every episode of your podcast, and I really appreciate the content that you put out. And every now and then you tease your own story, but I've never really heard the whole thing. But what you've teased here and there throughout the episodes have always been fascinating to me. So I wanted to have you on to flip the mic on you and figure out how in the world you got to where you are today. So I'm glad that you're here.
Oh, thanks, man. And obviously, I owe you a huge gratitude, debt of gratitude. You've obviously, not everyone will know, but in the background, I'm always pinging you, asking you for help and advice with working on my podcast. So thank you so much. And obviously, I'm a big listener of yours too. And yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. And, you know, anybody that's ever done any audio or video knows how much of a pain in the butt it is. So we just talk about the weed stuff. All the content is yours, and you've really done a fantastic job of getting great guests. And I want to talk about what some of the most interesting interviews you've had so far are, some of your takeaways. Before we get to all that, though, you've been in crypto for what, a little over a year now?
Well, I kind of came in two phases. The first phase was around 2013, where there was this website where you could buy stuff, which somebody introduced me to. I'd heard of Bitcoin because I worked in tech, but so I bought and sold a little bit of Bitcoin, and then as the price started to go up, it was that rally up to $1,200. I was buying Bitcoin and CFDs on plus 500, making a lot of money very quickly, and then lost a lot of money very quickly. We used to get the middle of the night price crashes, where it would just, the price would dump for a second and you get a margin call. So that was a...
This was in 2013.
2013, on the run up to $1,200. But I wasn't involved in the tech at all. I didn't understand Bitcoin. I hadn't really looked at it. I just tried to make some money and did quickly, lost it quickly. Very emotional, very, very traumatic at times. And then also was trading CFD tech stocks. So I hit Tesla when it first hit its first run. But also I was holding a long position which closed when the market closed, and then there was a price, no, I was holding a short position, there was news overnight which saw a massive price dump in the aftermarket. Massive price rise in the aftermarket. Because I was short, I lost a huge amount of money overnight, totally not knowing what I was doing. So I decided to go back to what I was doing, which was running my agency, and give up being a trader, because it wasn't for me.
Okay, you went through what a lot of people listening to this are going through now, where there's a boom and bust story, but you've already did that once back in 2013.
Yes, and learned some lessons which I brought through to this time, but not all of them. I just experienced the early mistakes of over leveraged, guessing sometimes, the pain of losing money and the highs of making money. I mean, there were times you got to think, you know, like you could have a day where I was earning as much as I'd earn in a month of work of running my agency. But at the same time, I've had days where I'd lost as much. I learned some very, very painful lessons very quickly, which helped me the next time around. But I'm still far from
let's,
a good
let's
trade.
Stay back there for a minute, though, because you learned, or you first acquired Bitcoin because you were essentially dealing with medical issues with your mother. And I know you've been pretty open about that story. That was the second time.
Okay. Yeah. So what happened was I'd come out of it and I'd said, you know, this isn't for me.
Okay. So all of the 2013 stuff was about speculation. Like but how did you think, like, this is something I can speculate on versus this is something I can use as a tool for transacting money in ways that people, you know, nation states didn't design for me to transact?
Yeah, I guess I never looked into it that deeply. It was just a fleeting kind of few months of exposure. I guess I'm not one of those people who gets something quickly. It takes me a bit of time. So I never really looked at it that much. And I was kind of still in that world of, this is just fake money, but I'll make something off it while I can. But at the same time, I did, you know, I was aware of the Silk Road. I did realize, okay, there's this kind of cool thing where you can transact and not worry about prying eyes, but didn't take too much of a look at it then. It got more serious the second time around. It was Christmas 2016. Obviously, I've mentioned before, I've not hidden away from this. My mum had late-stage ovarian cancer, and I'd been doing some research, and I have a friend who works in research into medical cannabis. And from everything I'd read, it appeared that it was worth a try. There's no conclusive evidence for and no conclusive evidence against. And you get lost in this whole world of there's content out there that's hugely supportive of medical marijuana and these examples of people who've been, you know, stage four lung cancer, who've then been using CBD and survived. And then there's also other articles out there with people who are just saying, though, there's no medical science behind this, and it's just a waste of time. So you kind of get lost in it all, but it was worth a try.
You were just seeking something that you could help give your mom comfort.
Well, so we'd got to the stage where she was on her final treatment, and that had failed. So we got to that awful stage where, I mean, I remember we're in the hospital in Ireland, and the doctor says, there's, you know, they're trying to ask you questions in a way which isn't too upsetting, but encouraging you that to move on and accept that treatment isn't going to work. And, you know, none of us of the family wanted to accept that. My father didn't, my mum didn't. And she was an incredibly strong woman as well. She never once spoke of dying. She was always positive, and she'd done a lot of things, like she'd gone vegan. She didn't drink. She gave up sugar. I mean, the strange thing is, prior to 6 months before she died, she probably looked the best she'd looked in 10 years, which is kind of ironic. Mm. But I'd never convinced her to do the cannabis oil. She, in her mind, it was a drug. So it was an equal to cocaine and heroin. She didn't know the difference. But when we got to that final moment that nothing else will work, she said she'll try it. So I said to Dad, there's these websites that you can buy it from. You have to use something called Bitcoin. And he was like, fine, just go and do it. So I'd gone on to Coinbase. Actually, I'd gone on to Google and I searched where to buy Bitcoin, because years ago I'd bought from local Bitcoins. For no reason at all, I just went on Coinbase and did a search for buy Bitcoin, and up came Coinbase. So I registered an account. I bought a Bitcoin. You know, we bought what my mum required, which was less than actually a Bitcoin. So I had some left over, and just ignored that Coinbase for that moment. And, you know, the delivery came. We got it to Ireland. We got it to mum. She tried it. And then we were spending a lot of time in Ireland because mum was sick, and I'd also quit work the year before. So I had a lot of time on my hands. And while I was at my dad's, I remember going to transfer the leftover Bitcoin back to Coinbase because I didn't want to leave it on the website. And then when I was on Coinbase, I saw this other thing, Ethereum. So in between going to see mum and then being kind of stuck at the house, I started to have a look again. So sadly, mum died. She died 12th of January that year. So it was too late for her. Strangely, at a time in my life I was very lost, the journey to find her, this treatment, has created this new life for me. So I put a tweet out. I think it was on the anniversary of her. Oh, no, it was on her birthday last year. I just explained that strangely, the life I live now is all because of my mum, and she's actually completely unaware that it's happened. I feel like I'm rambling here, but
I think the personal story of how someone not only got into something from an investment point of view, but also, like, this is basically your career right now. So I think an important component to describe how you view the entire space. And I guess that was ended up being fortuitous timing, because you're talking about the beginning of 2017. That was essentially just in time for the major run-up. And you're talking about Ethereum especially. So what kind of, from a pricing perspective, what were you looking at there with Ethereum? And then, general...
it was very strange timing, like you say. It was very fortuitous. I'd had this career in advertising, and when I got divorced, I stopped, and my life had become this kind of car crash, and I didn't know what to do. So I turned around to my dad and said, look, this Bitcoin thing looks interesting again. I'm going to put some money into it. So I decided to buy 5 Bitcoin at the time, and then with my leftover money, with this Ethereum, not knowing anything about it or what it was or what it meant, I had whatever I'd left over. I just bought Ethereum because it was $9. I just thought, I'll buy it.
Ethereum was $9.
And it was quite funny at the time, because it would go maybe to $8.50, and I'd be like, oh my God, this is terrible. You know, like, and then I just decided to go out and buy everything. I just had this kind of feeling. I don't know what it was. Call it luck or whatever. But then I bought Dash at $14, Monero at $12. My biggest hit was, funnily enough, with Ripple, which I can't stand now. I bought that at some ridiculously low price. It was like half a cent. I hit some kind of 6,000% return or something stupid on that. But in the end, I just kept putting money in. I invested in English pounds. It was about £23,000. I think it's about $31,000 into a range of things. And then, everyone knows what happens through the rest of 2017. It was obviously a fortuitous year for anyone who got in early enough, which has been, conversely, a terrible year for anyone who's not got out quick enough this year. So it was a very interesting year of learning, thinking I'm a trader and learning very quickly I'm not a trader.
So you, I guess you say learning that you're not a trader because, one, I think if you buy Ethereum at $9 and looking at the chart on Coinbase around when you were buying, that was essentially the lowest it ever was on Coinbase. With that availability, that degree of availability. But basically right before that massive run-up, I think if you were a trader, it would have been extremely hard for justifying holding Ethereum up to that $200, $300, $400 range because it was an incredible run. But I'm assuming that with all of these, you essentially held on and were like, this is fine. This is the way. Did it feel normal to you going through this journey of all of your stuff going up 1,000% plus?
It just didn't. I can't even explain it. It's a very hard thing to explain because I didn't know what I was doing, but obviously I thought I was a genius, yeah. But I didn't know what I was doing. And it's funny, like I've almost gone through, I think a lot of people do this. You go through this bull market, you think you're a genius and then the bull market ends and then you kind of realize what you are. And I've come to realize I'm not cut out to be a trader. It's not where my skills lie. We all have our skills and I could probably learn to trade, but it isn't where my skills are. What it has done is given me the opportunity to put my skills into something which I think I'm probably better at, which is, and what I prefer to do, which is, you know, interviews and content. But none of it made sense, you know. And I was very lucky with some of my timing, you know, like I bought Ethereum, whatever price I bought, however much I bought. I think I sold a bunch at 250 and then a bunch at about 350. And same with Ripple. Look, with so many of these things, and I was just flipping from one to the other. I would just buy anything. I was literally just buying anything, and everything was going up. I mean, you couldn't make a bad investment for significant parts of the year. When I look back and I realize why I wasn't a good trader is that it's only been this year that I've realized that the trading for BTC makes much more sense than trading on the dollar charts. But add to that, I also realize that yes, you trade on the BTC chart, but you should also be taking money back into fiat in certain conditions. So I recognize the things you should do. I'm just not one of those people who's built to trade and to read and understand markets. I went through that year of thinking I'm a genius. Look how much money I've made. I've gone through 2018 thinking, shit, I've lost now loads of this money. I don't actually know what I'm doing. I'm definitely going to focus on creating podcasts and leave trading to the very good people. And, you know, I'll keep my fingers kind of in the market a little bit, and I'll always hold some Bitcoin, but I'm definitely not cut out to be a trader. And do you know what? The other thing is, this bear market, as painful as it is for most people who've experienced it, I think it's also an eye-opener into what exists within the market and where value has been created. And where I was buying things in, you know, I was buying Dash and thinking, this is another cool currency, or Litecoin, I was thinking, this is another cool currency, or I was buying Augur because I think that system sounds great. I can now look at it a bit more objectively now and say, okay, it doesn't really make sense to have multiple currencies, and actually there is no intrinsic value in these tokens unless some form of scarcity is reverse engineered or engineered into it, and
or network
I'm starting
value.
Or network value, but the only two things that make sense to me in terms of price right now are Bitcoin and Monero. Like everything else is for me is hugely overpriced. I mean, you look at the market cap of Augur, and it's got, what did they say, 64 users the other day? Daily users. So I can't make sense of this market, and I'm not very good at trading it. So I'm leaving the trading to the people like you and the other experts. And I think I'm just very fortunate I now have this new career of being able to do interviews, and very lucky that I hit the market when I did.
It's funny that... for many of us, it really takes the market reversing on us before we're even willing to have that conversation of what's the actual inherent value here. When it's going up, we're like, yeah, this is perfectly logical, all this rise in value, because look at the potential of this technology. Of course...
But we have so much bias, right?
Yeah, because our accounts are getting larger while we're saying it, so it feels very easy to make that type of statement. But you're still invested, and it sounds like you're willing to be invested going forward to some degree. And you're saying right now you're not interested in anything other than Bitcoin or Monero. But I presume that once you feel like market caps may be bottom or stabilize or whatever, you'll be interested in investing in other projects? Or do you, are you essentially becoming a maximalist? I know you've been doing a lot of research about this. And this whole journey has led you to try to understand where a lot of highly opinionated people that you interview, where they're coming from. So are you still open to the idea of altcoins or networks or smart contract platforms and all that stuff as an investment vehicle in the future?
Oh, yeah. Look, I'm totally open-minded. And the thing about doing a podcast, as you know, you have to be open-minded. I'm not a Bitcoin maximalist, but the reason I've started going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, there's a couple of reasons. I've pissed off a lot of Bitcoiners through my choice of guests, and I think I come across on Twitter different than I probably do on my podcast, because on Twitter I'm just having a bit of fun and poking people and throwing a few hand grenades out. But I started to see that so many people are blocking me, and they all tend to be Bitcoiners. I wanted to know what I was missing. So I started to go down that. I'm reading Saifedean Ammous's book, The Bitcoin Standard. I'm trying to, it's a great book. I'm delving into Austrian economics. I'm trying to understand it. And I guess where I am right now is that I 100% support that the notion that there will be a single store of value. And most of the value will accrue to a winner takes all, similar to how Saifedean explains gold and silver, when there were countries who based their economy on gold and silver. And as gold became the standard, those economies based on silver, I think India was the example he gave, their currency crumbled. So they eventually moved to gold. So I get that. And that's why I struggle then with Litecoin and Dash. As all currencies.
Why don't you struggle with Monero from the same point of view?
Not right now. I think it has an interesting use case because it appears to be the best privacy coin. And I think privacy coins are interesting. And as Bitcoin doesn't have full privacy at the moment, I can see the use case. But I am keeping an open mind for the rest of the market. So I think stable coins are very interesting. I find the whole crypto thing interesting in terms of the ability to move money and value and assets around the world at the click of a button. I think that's really interesting. And I don't call myself a Bitcoin maximalist because I think it's interesting that there are other coins and other tokens and that you can exchange between tokens. And therefore, you can swap between, you essentially can create little ecosystems and infrastructures for moving value. I think that's super interesting. I therefore think there's a bunch of people who would like to get involved in this, who would probably want to tokenize certain assets, but would rather do it with a stable coin because the volatility is no use. So if you're, if you're a venture capitalist, you don't want to raise funds in ETH, which might drop 70%. You'd much rather raise in a stable coin. But there can be a guy in Vietnam who wants to invest in something and he's got his Bitcoin. He can convert that into the stable coin and then invest. So I think the ability to move between different currencies, which have different values and different use cases, is interesting. So I like Bitcoin.
Well, that's the unit of account component of crypto. And really, from a point of view of saying Bitcoin can meet these pillars, the various pillars that make a quality currency, Bitcoin is not very good on the unit of account side. Like, it's pretty good on the store value side. It's strengthening in terms of its transactability, but it's pretty weak due to its volatility in terms of unit of account, because you can't write a contract and say, I'm going to give you this thing for 3 Bitcoin. And that contract, especially an ongoing thing. Imagine running your agency still, you were doing consulting, and say, for 1 Bitcoin a month, we're going to do these services for you. And you're like, well, I don't know what 1 Bitcoin a month is worth. And I have payroll. And those people, they want to be paid in dollars of something that can have a stable unit of account. So I agree with you in terms of, I think actually a stable coin that works and has auditability and all this stuff, and that can get beyond the size of the crypto ecosystem. So I think Tether's fine for a stable coin as within the crypto ecosystem, but trying to create a digital currency in the broader world, I think is what's going to be really challenging. The stable coin that can crack that, I think will be very powerful and potentially be a threat to Bitcoin's own store value purposes.
That is a potential. Yeah, an absolute threat. I mean, the unit account thing is funny. I remember buying a Trezor, and the delivery was so long that when I cancelled the order, I received a different amount of Bitcoin back. So essentially, I got less Bitcoin back because the price had moved. So I had a disagreement with them. I said, "Well, I paid in Bitcoin."
Yeah.
They said, "Well, you've paid, but we quote in dollar." So we had that discussion, which I thought was kind of interesting. But look, I am open-minded. Like, I think there's something interesting in Ethereum, although I have a lot of doubts about it now, because I think the biggest problem I have with Ethereum and a lot of these protocols. Well, I have two primary issues. My first primary issue is that the protocol itself, and I'm going to get out of my depth here a little bit, but the protocol itself accrues value in that I compare it to the internet. It's almost like paying gas for TCP/IP, right? If you had to pay gas for TCP/IP, I don't think the internet would be as successful as it is now. I tried this this decentralized Twitter. Not that I thought it would be any good, but I had a go just to take a look at it, and I had to pay a gas cost.
Yeah, this is the one. This is the Peepeth or whatever, the one that Vitalik signed up for and inadvertently exposed a
huge wallet,
Ethereum wallet that he had $5 million. And it, for him, it's probably his like liquid Ethereum.
That's
wallet,
his small change,
not gold storage stuff.
So
yeah,
but I had to pay a gas cost to post, and I just thought, firstly, the experience was slow and boring and difficult, but also I just thought, I don't buy into a world where every time I complete an action, I have to pay a transaction to post it. It just doesn't make sense to me. I think that part of the protocol needs to be free, and it's when you actually use a service. So I think I struggle with that, and then I also struggle with having value in the token. So a utility token to me has almost no value, and there's no reason to speculate on it. For me, it's like going to, was it Disney last week, going and buying a bunch of Disney tokens, tickets, and standing outside and trying to sell them at the busy times. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And I also don't think the users, the retail and consumers, will like suddenly having to move to a world where they're using services that they have to then manage tokens, which have different values and different volatility. For this stuff to work for me, it almost has to be invisible. And it has to be the technology has to make something cheaper or faster or better. It's not that it's going to be decentralized. So I'm keeping an open mind, but I'm becoming very skeptical about most of the things I see.
And I almost entirely agree with you on that. Although I'm not opposed to the idea that some of these networks can have value, but I think that has to be somewhat designed into the system. I do think that Ethereum as a platform, I don't even know that Vitalik or whoever else is in charge of Ethereum cares about whether Ethereum, the token, has value as much as they care about the idea of creating decentralized networks that can be powered by Ethereum. So I think they could have protocol changes that enable some of these things to get better, like what you talked about with the gas cost. I don't want to do that either, but I think that we could see a lot of improvements, whether that's on the main chain or side chains or whatever else. There's a lot of work being done to try to scale those. And then, of course, there's all these other protocols working to make those changes too. What's that?
I think there's almost too many protocols, not enough dApps.
Well, absolutely. But that's how it goes when you're in a... We're almost in the research phase still, but we're in a research phase that the whole world can speculate on because of the openness of these investing ecosystems.
But I think it's possibly these systems are too complicated to build and the trade-off isn't really there. Like, I from my tech background, I'm a big fan of Eric Ries's book, The Lean Startup. I'm a big fan of product market fit, minimum viable product. And the way he says, whatever you think your minimum viable product is, it's probably even more minimum than you think. So if you go back and look at the MVP for Groupon, you remember Groupon?
Yeah.
It was just like, I think it was like a single page and he just used to post deals up and he built from that. You know, a lot of the businesses you can build a single page on a WordPress website and test it. Something like Augur, they've spent like 2 to 3 years to build their public MVP, let's say. Yeah. And even that's difficult to use. And that doesn't have many regular users. And it doesn't have a great trade-off versus centralized websites prediction that can offer markets. Betting services.
And yeah, prediction markets has a ton of legal ramifications.
Yeah, so I'm wondering I think the hope of Bitcoin has created a flood of people who want to try and adapt that for other things that I don't think there's maybe a market for.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with you. That said, I don't think it'll stop there from being a speculation market. Moving to whatever is worthy of speculation. So, like, let's say the token economy is no longer worth speculating on because it just sinks and sinks and sinks, goes to zero, the ICO model dies, whatever. Speculators are going to speculate, and they'll find something that's crypto-based to speculate on. Right now, what we're seeing that on is with Bitcoin itself. Like, the derivative platforms have enormous volume speculating on the price changes in Bitcoin, and I think we'll continue to see Bitcoin and other potential competitors continue on. Take a moment to say thank you to Delta, our partner for this episode. Delta is the best way to track your crypto portfolio. They recently had another update, and they're calling this one a quality of life update because they've had some really big ones, feature updates, and this one's more granular, just digging into the various user experiences of the app, and I've really enjoyed them. For one, if you want to set your portfolio as percentages only, that's now cross-portfolio, which is really great. If you get an alert, it'll take you straight to the detail page for that coin. Those alerts are super, super nice. And you can establish your notifications on a per coin basis too. So there's just lots of great stuff like that. And they're always doing these types of updates. If you haven't tried Delta, you should today. You get so much for free with Delta, and they do have a pro version if you want to pay a little bit extra to get the pro version and unlock even more features. For instance, I don't input any of my own transactions anymore because I just have Exchange Sync built right in, and now I don't have to do that thing where I buy or sell a coin and then go put it in an app. I just let them take care of that for me. It's really great. Go to ledgerstatus.com/delta, and thanks so much for Delta being a Ledger Status partner. I want to dig more into fundamentals, but I want to ask you some questions that I just wanted to have a go with you because okay. I love your podcast. I really do. I listen to every episode. I think that you give everyone a voice and you give them the opportunity to explain themselves. My question is,
okay, thank you.
For some people, why do you think they deserve a platform to explain themselves when some of their activity is so clear in the world for just being... just pretty much wrong, like they've made a very clear name for themselves for being a scammer or whatever else. Like Craig Wright is a great example. I think Roger Ver may be a different story. Roger was a huge proponent of the Bitcoin ecosystem. Craig Wright, you could argue, has really never done anything of value for the cryptocurrency ecosystem. So why does someone like Craig Wright deserve a broader voice?
Good question. I've taken a lot of flack from it, including threats of violence.
I know you have. I want to speak on that on the behalf of those critical voices. I'm personally torn on it. I personally would not give Craig Wright a platform. I think even talking about him right now is giving him maybe too much of a platform. But there's a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a fair question and it's a good question, and if I could do it again, I would still interview him, but I would construct the interview probably in a different way. I mean, one thing people need to remember is I'm not a journalist. I was working in advertising. I had an advertising agency that collapsed after my divorce. I fell into this podcast thing, and that was something like my 12th interview, right? So I'm very new.
Yeah.
I'm very new to Bitcoin. I'm very new to interviewing, and You know, I went back and listened to a couple of my earlier first interviews the other day, and I thought they were great at the time. I look back now and I'm a bit cringy. You know, this takes time and you learn. But the first thing I would say is I actually take issue when people say giving a platform, because for me, this isn't what do you call it? This isn't a, I'm not giving a platform, I'm constructing an interview. A platform is something like, I don't know, in the UK, political parties get a certain amount of time on TV to present their case. Or if you go to a
platform being like a public venue,
yeah,
whereas you're saying people can come watch this, or they don't have to. This is just me talking.
Yeah, and do you know what? Look, does every single person in crypto hate Craig Wright?
No, but I don't.
No, so there are people who but what I'm going to say, how many of those people who are against me interviewing Craig Wright are also up in arms about what's happened with Alex Jones these last few days? I bet there are some people who think it's bullshit that Alex Jones has lost his voice on social media platforms, but are also pissed off with me for interviewing Craig Wright. And whether or not you like Craig Wright or not, I don't like Alex Jones. I think everything he said about
Sandy
Hook.
Repulsive.
Yeah, I think he's repulsive, and everything he said about Sandy Hook. And I think fucking great he's not on there. But it's there is a lot of hypocrisy there. The reason I interviewed Craig Wright and the reason I interview everyone is I want to learn. And I feel if I'm learning, I'm helping others learn. And whatever people think of Craig Wright, he was definitely involved in Bitcoin very early on. And even though he's fake Satoshi, there are definitely some things in there that are kind of interesting, like his relationship with Dave Klayman, his early involvement.
Yeah.
And I find that intriguing, and I want to learn about it. And whatever people think of him, he is involved in Bitcoin Cash. Bitcoin Cash does trade on Coinbase and pretty much every other exchange. It is part of our ecosystem, whatever people think of it. I don't like Bitcoin Cash. I don't trade it. I don't mine it anymore. I've got nothing to do with it. But I would interview people who are involved in it, and I would put the questions to them. Because I think it's like, where do you draw the line? You know, the argument I always give back, and I've never seen a good counter argument, is Louis Theroux is obviously one of my favorite interviewers. He interviews some of the worst people. He interviews murderers, pimps, Nazis, drug dealers, but he interviews them to get to the story and understand the story behind them. And my choice to interview Craig or Roger or Morgan or anybody who is maybe not the nicest person in the world or people agree with is, I still want to find out the story. I still want to meet them and look them in the eye and ask them the questions I want to answer. If people don't like it, then so be it. They don't have to listen to the interview. But my giving them an interview is not destroying Bitcoin. My interview with Craig Wright will do no damage to Bitcoin, and it will do no damage to other people. But we can't live in a world where we don't interview people just because we don't like them. And I will never change my opinion on that.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that in principle. What I do personally disagree with is that I am certain that if I interviewed Craig Wright, or even if I interviewed Roger Ver, I'm not going to get anything new out of those guys. Because take Craig, for instance. He only has to do one thing to prove he's Satoshi. And yet, he's going around the world saying he's Satoshi. All he has to do is sign the Genesis block. And he can prove it. He can, he can win. He's not done it. Either because he can't, or because he's not Satoshi. Like, there's either some technical reason, like he lost his Bitcoin. So Satoshi losing the Genesis block keys is hilarious in its own right, potentially. Or he can't do it because he's a fraud. And I'm not going to learn anything from Craig personally, because he will refuse to answer question zero. And for me, if he's going to claim he's going to be Satoshi, then he needs to be Satoshi. In my opinion, I'm bringing on someone who is unwilling to be truthful from the outset, so I can't trust anything else they'll say. In Roger's instance, to me, he takes the same marketing message to any platform. He's been on Alex Jones's show, for example, and he told a lot of the same spin and a lot of the same lies there that he'll take anywhere. And I've never really seen him bring something new to the table. I think you got one thing out of him that I enjoyed, which was you asked him, what did he regret? And it was baffling to me that the only thing he could bring himself to admit that he regrets about how the whole last, whatever, year and a half went down, was he wished that he wouldn't have flipped off John Carvalho. It's like,
yeah.
Is that really all that he can come up with?
Yeah, I think you make fair points. I guess it's a couple of things, though. I mean, people have to remember, you know, I don't get paid for this podcast, and I've invested a lot of money into it. So really, it's a personal project that people get to come along on the ride for or not. That, you know, and people are welcome to judge, and I'll take every opinion on board. But as I said,
I want to clarify. I think that you have every right to do it. I'm just challenging you personally to say, hey, I love your show, but why those guys? Is basically my point.
Yeah, I mean, there's multiple reasons. And you've got to treat each individually. Craig Wright was probably one of my most challenging interviews. So for me, as somebody learning to interview, it's a good thing to do, to learn how to interview a slippery person. But personally, I just wanted to get to the story. I want to understand him, and it won't be the last we hear of him, but I understand him better now, having met him, talked to him, and interviewed him, and actually had the live discussion with him. Like I say, if I did the interview now, it'd be very different because I know more and I've learned more. But he is involved in the space, and therefore I wanted to interview him. Roger was very different. Roger's one of those tough ones because he's obviously... a lot of people think he's a liar. He tells compulsive lies. He is trying to damage the Bitcoin brand. I don't think he's having actually that much of an impact on it. But at the same time...
I think that the degree that he goes around and says Bitcoin Cash is Bitcoin, and the role that he plays with Bitcoin.com is actually incredibly damaging to the overall brand.
See, I look at it the other way. I think it increases the Bitcoin anti-fragility long term.
I think the challenge that was presented to Bitcoin and the response that Bitcoin had in price and whatnot did show some of the anti-fragility and probably helped encourage the speculative run that happened in 2017. I still think it's potentially damaging. I knew a lot of people that were very confused about Bitcoin versus Bitcoin Cash, and if you can find a lot of old material of Roger being a huge proponent of Bitcoin, and I think what he's doing, I think it can chip away at Bitcoin and really hurt the potential as a long-term thing, a long-term store value currency, whatever you want to call it. And
yeah, I mean, I agree, but the thing about Roger is I have this split feeling on him because I also know the work he's done in the background to support Ross Ulbricht and support the family and help their legal case and the donations he's made. And that obviously is a case which is also important to me. But you can't get to the... Look, I'm coming essentially since 2016 and Bitcoin's 9 years old. I'm trying to learn as much as I can. I don't want to take everything on face value. I've been attacked by Bitcoiners for interviewing Roger, and I've been attacked by Bitcoin Cash guys for interviewing Samson, and you get attacked in every direction. But by meeting every person and doing every interview, you get the full story. And I'm trying to explain this in the most diplomatic way possible. Whilst I don't agree with Bitcoin Cash, I have sympathies with some of their arguments. I have sympathies that Bitcoin has changed. Look, it has changed. It's changed for the better, but some people didn't want it to change. I think it's a real shame that they didn't do the fork and just name it something else. Because the fork itself is useful to Bitcoin.
I mean, there's 1,000 altcoins that are Bitcoin forks.
Of course.
The difference, I'm fine, perfectly fine. Roger and whoever else can go and have a field day creating a coin and calling it something other than Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I personally just find it a moral failure to tell the public that you're Bitcoin something when you're not. And
I guess
to me, that's the beef that's a non-starter for any of the other conversations.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he is, and a lot of people alongside him are of the fundamental belief that that their version is the true Bitcoin and that Bitcoin itself isn't because it's not following Satoshi's white paper. Look, I think that's bullshit, but at the same time, it's important for me as somebody who wants to interview everybody and consume and understand as much as I can to have the conversation with him. And, you know, it's no small deal flying out to Japan to interview Roger Ver. I spent probably 3 to 4 days, full days preparing for the interview. I watched all his previous interviews. I watched the John Carvalho one and thought, God, you know what? I can try and wind Roger up and get him to flick the bird and everyone thinks I'm great because I created a meme. I didn't want to do that. I researched how to interview tricky people, how to interview politicians. My entire interview with Roger was constructed in a way to get him to admit a fault, because I'd never seen him in any of his interviews admit a fault. Every single interview was a script, mm-hmm. You know, the stock answer to the same things he'd done before. What I wanted to do was to get him to admit a fault, which he did. And he admitted that he was wrong to
lose his temper
for his criticism of John's career. And what was very interesting is after that point, once he did that, his whole demeanor changed. In the interview, he sat back and he relaxed. And we had a good 30, 40 minutes after the interview talking about Ross and his case and other things. And the Roger I spent 40 minutes with afterwards is a very different person from who everyone sees on YouTube.
And I can, you know, I can totally believe that. And I'm actually pretty struck by the political altruism by a lot of the people that were early to the Bitcoin ecosystem. And you've interviewed a lot of them, Roger. I mean, I can totally see his politics shine through in the things that he does, and they may get out of hand at times, but they are a reflection of his underlying very strongly held political beliefs. The same with Eric Voorhees. In other ways, and in Jameson Lopp. And I'm curious what takeaways you have in terms of the overlap of early adopters and people that are still influential in the ecosystem relative to their broader politics.
Oh, good question. I think everybody compromises their beliefs a little bit at some point, right? You know, Roger's working on Bitcoin Cash and has worked on other projects. Eric Voorhees has Shapeshift, which allows you to trade a number of different tokens.
But it's very centralized. Jason, and he was also a big proponent of SegWit2x.
Yeah, he was.
There was a multi-month overlap for Eric where he could have supported the soft fork and supported SegWit. And his whole claim was he was happy that SegWit came to Bitcoin. But he held on to the 2x side of things for a long time. That makes you question some of those strongly held beliefs, like you said.
Continue. And Jameson Lopp's working on Casa, which is a custody solution which will allow eventually the custody of tokens. So, look, I think in the end, even if you're a libertarian, one problem I have is libertarians who are also Bitcoin maximalists who aren't supportive of a free market for tokens. It's kind of this weird contradiction, and I'm definitely out of my depth on this, but the Bitcoin maximalists who think everything else is a shitcoin, think everything else is bullshit, but also support free markets. We have a free market, and that's great. And I think it's really cool that we have this, but we're all compromised at some point with business. Like I'm definitely seeing an understanding of Bitcoin maximalism. At the same time, I'm running a podcast. I may have a token say to me, hey, Pete, we would like to advertise on your podcast. We'll give you $5,000 for a month. I'm then conflicted because they are offering me an income that supports my podcast and mm-hmm. supports my costs. At the same time, I might think their token is a shitcoin and a waste of time. It's like, you know, what do you do? It's a free market. They should be able to advertise. I run the risk of maximalists going, oh, Pete's bullshit. He says he's a maximalist, but he's taking adverts for shitcoins. So we're in this kind of weird place where we're all some, we're, one time or another, our beliefs are probably going to be compromised or questioned when business reality hits. I don't think I've answered your question in the way you asked it.
No, I think we're getting there. And I don't... You know, I don't disagree. I think there's a difference between, I think what we're seeing a lot is people can have their beliefs, and it's not like they're trying to say anything but Bitcoin needs to be illegal, but part of a free market is their ability to essentially maintain a public relations campaign, doing as much as possible to make people realize that Bitcoin is the only real candidate, and all the other stuff they believe will eventually go to zero. Because what we've seen is, the token economy, or whatever you want to call it, has taken a lot of the dominance away from Bitcoin. Bitcoin would be larger today without the token economy takeoff that we've seen, the all the Ethereum stuff and all the other alternative cryptocurrencies, the Dashes and the Ripples and the Bitcoin Cashes, that money would have funneled into Bitcoin. So we're actually seeing a strategic campaign.
I don't agree with that.
Well, Bitcoin's a lot of people would say, and Bitcoin maximalists included, that right now Bitcoin's best use case is speculating on all that other stuff. But as Bitcoin,
I discussed this with Pierre in my last podcast, because I actually think altcoins have a net positive effect on Bitcoin.
Okay.
I think for a couple of reasons. Firstly, Bitcoin is essentially the base layer currency for all crypto. So to buy most crypto, you need Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And
it's the reserve
therefore,
currency.
Even if you don't believe, exactly. So even if you don't believe in Bitcoin, to be an altcoin trader, you kind of have to buy and hold Bitcoin, right? So the biggest use case for Bitcoin at the moment is probably trading altcoins. And the opportunity to make money on all these different altcoins has brought so many people into the market, which I don't think Bitcoin would have achieved on its own. So I think that's had a net positive value. But I also think the other net positive value is that all these altcoins continue to increase Bitcoin anti-fragility. And so therefore, and I put this to Pierre, and he was of agreement and a supporter of that. So I don't think that money would have flowed into Bitcoin. I think if Bitcoin had been on its own, I think a lot of the money might not have come.
Yeah, I definitely think that that is an accurate argument in the near term of Bitcoin proving Bitcoin's value and also showing off Bitcoin's primary use case. My point is more so in the long term. If this is a forever thing, if there's a fracture of these ecosystems, I think that they can serve against Bitcoin. Like Bitcoin can be weaker in the long term if the alternative succeeds of like, oh, we'll just use any of these. And, you know, like there's all these different payment systems and whatnot. And Bitcoin's just one of them. To me, I think that weakens the crypto economy in the long term, even if trading all those different currencies is good for it in the short term.
Yeah, I don't see that happening though, personally. I think almost like we see now, I think the value will, it's the same with gold and silver. I think that most of the value will still end up going back to Bitcoin. In the end, people are going to put their money in the most safe place. And I still think it's a winner takes all in terms of the store of value. The other use cases are, you know, our use cases. There are other stores of value outside of gold. People just don't use them because they don't make any sense. So,
or they don't make as much sense.
I don't see as much sense. Yeah. But that doesn't worry me. I think ultimately the whole crypto ecosystem has had a net positive effect on Bitcoin.
So what threats do you see from people that put on their maximalist hat, but really they're also corporate-backed building layer two solutions where there's a profit mechanism? This is obviously like the block streams of the world, you know, like with so you interviewed Samson and his company is building a Lightning implementation, and there will be some form of profit components for their layer two services. Do you think that is equally potentially threatening to the crypto ecosystem as some of the altcoins or Bitcoin Cashes of the world? Basically, what merit do you think there is in that argument, which we see from a lot of people in the Bitcoin Cash ecosystem?
I understand why they're saying it. I just think it's an attack vector for them. I don't fully believe it. The really hard thing is getting to the real truth of all this. For every argument in crypto, there's a counter argument. Every counter argument, there's another counter argument. It's very hard to find single truth, which everyone believes and follows. So you can look at Blockstream and say, what they're doing is great. The things they're building are great for Bitcoin. And you can find arguments where people say, actually, this is Blockstream trying to control Bitcoin. They're controlling Core for their own profit. Finding the truth is very hard. All you have is a bunch of opinions. My view, they're just building layers on top of it. And naturally, there's venture money behind them. And naturally, there will be a profit component. And that's just the world we live in. I don't see anything insidious happening with Blockstream, but I understand where the argument comes from. But it's almost like politics. You know, especially if you look at American politics, everything Trump does, the Democrats hate. And everything the Democrats do, Trump hates. There's never really a middle ground. And this just feels like the same. It's just whatever they do, whatever somebody on the Bitcoin side will do, whether it's Bitcoin or Bitcoin Core, Bitcoin Cash people will find a reason to hate it, and vice versa. So I don't know. I think Bitcoin itself is fine.
I hear what you're saying, and I think politically it's playing out like that. I don't think it stops us from being able to objectively look at something and say, well, there is some underlying truth to the one side, and there are some abject lies and things that are not okay on the other side. A lot of people politically may hate me for that, but I think you can see that whether you're looking at U.S. politics or whether you're looking at crypto politics.
Yeah,
I think it's all equal and it all balances out, and there's the same amount of rights and wrongs on both sides. I don't think that's really true. I don't think that's how the world works.
No, I don't. And look, you only have to read through Roger Ver's Twitter to realize how much bollocks he talks sometimes and lies. And it's just mind-blowing. I mean, I always try to be as impartial as I can. And I always try to look at I do this on purpose. Every single tweet he will send out, I try and look at it with the fairest eyes I can and try and understand where he's coming from. More often than not, though, I just don't agree with what he's saying, and I know it's bullshit. At the same time, some of the voices on the Blockstream side, I don't think they always conduct themselves in the most professional way. But at the same time, and there is a very good, you can see how people can invent conspiracies about Blockstream and their relationship with Core and Bitcoin. I don't know enough about it. I don't think there's anything insidious there going on, but I do understand why there are conspiracies around it.
Yeah, and I see where people are coming from with that too, even though I also don't agree that there's a lot of merit to that. One of my big things for why I believe in the layer two ecosystem for Bitcoin is the inherent design of Bitcoin can never meet the true promise of, like, you know, all the payment transaction volume and all that stuff. It can meet all the store value components. Like, for the same reason that when we had gold-backed dollars, you didn't pay with little tiny chunks of gold. You had a dollar system on top of it. So the dollar was the layer two, the transaction system for gold itself. And I think that analogy is why it makes sense to me, why you can settle in an underlying Bitcoin, but that doesn't mean all your transactions, all your open channels of me giving you $1,000 and you giving me $1,000 and all that little stuff, or much less like $3, the cup of coffee thing, which I really don't like. All of that can happen on additional layers, and it can still be backed by an underlying Bitcoin component. So to me, it's natural to have a vast and vibrant layer two ecosystem, the same way we have all these competing merchant processors in the world, you know, for who's going to transact our online stuff and all those, you know, all those things. That just logically makes more sense to me versus infinitely scaling blocks so that we can put all the transactions of the world on bigger highways, you know, the cash side of things. I just don't get. Is that essentially, is that kind of where you've landed?
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, and it's so what I did is the process I went through is I took each side of the argument and I put myself in as if I agree. So I put myself in the position of agreeing with bigger blocks so I could get my head around it, understand what the argument was, and then I did the same with layer two. And a lot of the technical stuff is quite complicated, especially on Lightning Network. Trying to understand it's very complicated. But I did both, and I came to the conclusion that I agree with smaller blocks. Actually, Jameson Lopp's debate with Roger Ver is still probably one of my favorite ever podcasts, like ever. And the way Jameson Lopp approached that interview and the arguments he gave in support of smaller blocks and Lightning Network were pretty compelling. So I came to the conclusion that small blocks are essential, and came away with sympathy for people who believe in big blocks, in that the people who've built, you know, Bitcoin was, the white paper said, a peer-to-peer electronic payment system for e-commerce, essentially. And there are people who built businesses online based on that. And then they had to drop Bitcoin because it became too slow. I have a huge amount of sympathy for them. And but I now realize the bigger picture is more important. That the journey and that Bitcoin's going on, what's being built is more important. I still think Lightning Network has a lot to prove. There are things I don't like about it in that there's a, essentially it's a two-layer system in terms of wealth. You know, there will be people, if Bitcoin does become this huge global store of wealth and currency that's used by millions of people daily, there will be people who can't afford to use the main chain and they will be on...
Yeah, Lightning. I think that was compelling when you were talking to Jameson about that, how essentially some people, their entire wealth will be purely on Lightning because they can't afford to settle onto the main chain.
But
I think that was...
But Sam, I put that to Samson as well, and he said, look, what do you want, socialism? And his point is correct. You know, this isn't so... It is a fairer capitalist system. And... yeah, I think there are plenty of things. It's just really exciting to see it all play out. I mean, I think Lightning is very exciting. I think what Starkness is doing there and her team is very exciting. I'm looking forward to using it. I don't think it will be used as much as people imagine, but I still think it's very exciting. And I've definitely come to the point where I support smaller blocks.
What have been some of your biggest takeaways from interviewing the people that you've interviewed so far? What do you say are like a couple top things that you've learned thus far in this journey?
Not to sound too much of a dick saying this, but I've learned a lot more about myself as well, like my own abilities and inabilities and what I want to do and what I want to do in my life. So there's, I'll put that out there first, but that's kind of my dick statement. But what have I learned? General takeaways is that the primary concern I find most people have is just getting on with their life, making some money, going home to their family and living their life. The big utopian dreams of what Bitcoin can achieve are amazing, and if it can make the world a better place, great. I would say 95% probably higher people are in this market to make more money and to better their lives and better the lives of their family, which isn't a bad thing, right?
No.
I take more individual things away. My two interviews now with Lynn Albrecht have been so important to me personally, and I think just to the wider community. And sitting across from somebody who should be living out her retirement with her husband in Costa Rica and seeing her family and maybe seeing grandkids is now her whole life has been changed, and she's now become a campaigner for improving. Justice in the prison system, you know, the amount of people who are locked up for nonviolent crime. She facing never seeing her son outside of a prison again. That is really important. Interviewing Alejandro Macedo about what's going on in Venezuela. You know, there are real personal stories behind this whole crypto thing. Real lives.
I think that interview that you did was one of the best examples of showing the role that Bitcoin can play and be very valuable, because even as Bitcoin was dumping, he was able to get money out of the Bolivar and into Bitcoin, and Bitcoin lost value, but he gained wealth relative by a substantial margin, purely because it protected him from the massive deflationary state that Venezuela was going through.
I mean, it wasn't him. So he's not based in Venezuela now, but he was that. You're giving.
He was telling, he was translating that story from someone else.
So when people ask me what my most important interviews are, my best one, they're my top two, Lynn and him, because they're very personal stories, but they are also real Bitcoin use case stories. You know, Silk Road was the ability to transact and buy things privately without, you know, things that are illegal. It was a proper open free market, a real use case for Bitcoin. You had to have Bitcoin. You had to buy and sell it to use it. And Venezuela is a real use case. It's not as widespread as people imagine, but there is an opportunity for Bitcoin to become one of the primary currencies within that country, and the government won't be able to do anything about it. And that is another.
And not just Venezuela.
Yeah, other countries. I mean, Zimbabwe is an important case, and crypto is looking possibly important to Iran as sanctions come in place as a way they can transact and move value between nation states. So there
I would say too, it's a there's this idea of I was listening to a Planet Money podcast the other day where they're talking about dollarization. So some states choose to dollarize themselves when they go through these currency crises. But sometimes the public just refuses to take the local currency anymore. And there's what's called a spontaneous dollarization. So I think what Bitcoin proposes, because a lot of these countries, they don't want to be dollarized because then it's like you're a colony of the US. Mm-hmm. So maybe far off world, when they can't sustain their own currency, a global world currency, Bitcoin or something else, whatever, that's digital. I could envision a world where multiple countries actually decide to use an alternative to the dollar, a non-fiat monetary system in lieu of either a local currency or dollarization. And to me, I think that's a really fascinating potential future for crypto.
Yeah, it's
because
super
right now, I think Bitcoin is probably the primary candidate for a non-dollar and non-local currency. Like if a public is going to go to something, I think Bitcoin is potentially going to be one of the organic places that a population goes to when their country is in crisis. And we're at no shortage of countries in crisis, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. I'd love to see the numbers as well, say for Venezuela, what in terms of currencies used and how much they're being used, you know, where does Bitcoin fit in? Because it's in there somewhere. You've got the Bolivar,
yeah,
you've got the dollar. You may have people using bordering countries' currencies. I mean, I don't know. So Jill Carlson would be the one to ask about that. She'd probably know. But I would be interested to see where Bitcoin is within that. I'd be interesting to know what's worse for a government. I would have thought Bitcoin is worse than dollarizing, because with Bitcoin, they have no control. At least if they dollarize the country, they have some control over what happens. They have almost zero control with Bitcoin. But I think it's absolutely fascinating.
I think there's a lot of really interesting geopolitical conversations around that front.
Yeah. I mean, I know with Venezuela, there was a project to try and airdrop Bitcoin all across the country to people. It comes with its own mm-hmm. issues, but I know that's an active project. But imagine we had a country that ran on Bitcoin. I mean, it would be truly fascinating. And if it worked, if Venezuela as a country recovered, you could see like a snowball effect for other countries suddenly adopting the currency. And then we could have a global currency, which is fascinating.
You've interviewed several people who have strong opinions about the U.S. government's role in particular, but also the Eurozone, various governments. Lynn Albrecht, Morgan, what's Morgan's last name?
Freeman. Not Freeman, Morgan Watworth.
Morgan Freeman.
Morgan
Freeman. and others who have legal cases where they believe the U.S. government was directly involved in monitoring what was going on relative to Bitcoin, that really didn't have a lot to do with the illegal transactions or Silk Road or any of that type of stuff, but was purely this concern, essentially protecting the U.S. dollar and trying to stamp out something that could in the future challenge it. This is my takeaway based on the interviews, based on what they said. Do you think that that's true, and that the U.S. government, especially in the world that we see today, where we're seeing this, this creation of real financial products, derivative products, where the SEC, the CFTC are involved? Do you think the government's as concerned about Bitcoin today as they may have been 2009 to 2012 or whatever, when a lot of these stories originated?
I mean, it's a tough thing to answer. You know, it's your country, not mine. But the NSA seems to want to know about everything. You know,
I don't think anybody disagrees about that.
I've watched the Snowden movie, and I think it's quite scary, the information they hold on people and they record and such. And therefore, it's only natural that because essentially the dollar is the global reserve currency, right? And Bitcoin is a potential threat, and it feels like a country that is essentially the police of the world would want to know what this currency is and what it's used for and why it's being used and who's using it and where it's being sent and can they tax it and can they own it? I can't see a scenario where they'd, why they wouldn't want to know what's going on with it. I guess they've possibly come to the conclusion they can't stop it. And fostering it and accepting it now is probably better than trying to ban it. I don't think China banning it...
Accepting it and then trying to find ways to regulate and control.
Well, look, if it could become a global currency and it can become a global store of value, you're better off... I assume you're better off having supported it and having most of it owned by people within your country than it existing elsewhere. I think China will live to regret banning it and restricting their government, their population's access to it, because if it, like I say, if it becomes a global standard, then they're going to be behind the rest of the world with it. I mean, I'm well out of my political depth here and economic depth, but I just think there's no logical reason now to not accept Bitcoin as a monetary value that people want to use. And it's the project is definitely one which, and I wouldn't be surprised if governments are buying up Bitcoin right now.
Well, we know the North Koreans are stealing as much as possible and potentially mining it as well.
Yeah.
So let's finish with, I want to know, what are you excited about today? And what are you looking forward to with your own projects, with what Bitcoin did world?
What am I excited about today? Gosh, I mean, I'm very excited with Bitcoin. I'm very excited, especially with Venezuela. You know, having read so much about what's happening there and speaking to Alejandro, I'm very excited that this thing that's been invented, this money that's been invented on computers, can actually replace a government, can actually replace the currency of a government, can help a country which is essentially a failed state. I think that's just so exciting to watch play out. Sadly, watching it at the same time, seeing a country suffer and people suffer, you know, unable to get food or basic supplies. I mean, it's terribly sad to watch at the same time, but I find that exciting. I find the adoption of the ETF thing exciting, not because of what will happen to price. I find the ETF exciting because it's just another step. It's another spoke in the wheel of Bitcoin becoming part of the mainstream. I find it all just so exciting to watch and play out. I'm finding watching Ethereum and the death spiral of all these ICOs exciting, because I think the majority of it's going to go to the wall. I think Ethereum is going to really struggle as most of these... I think there's too many funds exiting and not enough... too many projects exiting their raised funds and not enough new ICOs coming in and raising. Therefore, there's too much sell pressure. I find that exciting to watch, you know, the market being proven. So I find almost all of it exciting. On my own side, I'm just excited to carry on doing great interviews, meeting people and having them on the podcast. And it's, you know, it's a really interesting experience to... it's kind of funny. It's come full circle as well. When I was 15, I started a music fanzine, and I used to go around and interview bands. And nice. It's almost like everything's come full circle. So I'm looking forward to improving my skills as a. I hate using the word journalist. I don't know if you ever describe yourself as one.
No,
I feel like I'm broad saying it.
So in my other world, I also run a trade magazine, is what I call it. And some people try to label me as a journalist in that space, and I consistently refute it because I'm going to carry a lot of opinions. So you can call me an analyst, but I actively shrug off the journalist term. So I think you could adopt the analyst name relative to journalist. So, yeah.
But yeah, so but I'm excited to carry on meeting people and improve as an interviewer. You know, it's every time you do an interview, you learn more and you learn more about yourself and how to construct an interview. And I'm going to be launching a new podcast, which is non-crypto, which is broad and more general stories, just because I think there's other interesting stories out there. So yeah, just excited to carry on doing that. And hopefully this bear market will end. And yeah, that's it. Really, man.
Well, I'm excited to see what you create. I my prediction is that you'll have a lot of fun doing the non-crypto podcast. I'm not personally sure that you'll have more success monetizing that one relative to the crypto one. I think you'll continue to find success in crypto because you have done, in my opinion, a really great job with your interviews. And I wanted to push you on some of your choices of guests. And to be frank, my critiques are not just your Bitcoin Cash people. Pierre Richard is another example of someone who I think they're fascinating, but his dependability on being in an echo chamber is fascinating to me because he openly admits that he would rather just be in a room full of people that agree with him and shut out the people that don't. And that baffles me as a lifelong curious learner.
Yeah, it's a tough one, and you know, it's a fair point. But I think if anything, I've set the standard that I will interview anyone who's in the space, and yeah. I will always try and improve as a journalist. There's that word again. Always improve as an interviewer and try and do and construct better interviews. Like I said, I've done 28 now, and you know, you learn more about yourself as you do them. But I think by interviewing as many people as possible, you can get the broadest knowledge possible, and hopefully then come to better conclusions yourself.
Yeah, and I think you're doing a great job, and I appreciate the effort that you've put into this. And you have spent an ungodly amount of money visiting these people in person, which I've multiple times messaged you and asked you, like, why are you doing that? Like, you know, we have the internet. Like, we can talk right here. But yeah, I think it's provided a lot of value, and you've done a great job. I look forward to seeing what's next for you and who you'll be bringing on the show. I'll be listening, and I hope the people that are paying attention to this podcast will be listening as well. Everybody can go follow you at What Bitcoin Did pretty much everywhere. Be sure to subscribe to your show. And then, of course, whatever you do outside of crypto, I'll be paying attention to that too. Peter, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Monuments crumble.